Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Optimizing the Selection of First-Line Therapy in Patients with Multiple Myeloma. We have a great faculty today, Professor Xavier Leloup from the Hospital La Mettrie in the Poitiers University Hospital in Poitiers, France. Sorry for the mispronunciation there, Xavier. And Dr. Peter Voorhees from the Atrium Wake Forest Baptist Comprehensive Cancer Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Today we're here to talk about first-line therapy in multiple myeloma, particularly new and important information. As always, we will be discussing the use of agents and regimens that are outside the FDA indications, so check out the prescribing information for more. Here's where we're heading. We're going to chat a little bit about putting things in perspective in terms of where things are in myeloma research nowadays. I call it the myeloma time capsule. Then we'll get into some of the new data that just came out at ASH looking at the treatment of smoldering myeloma with daratumumab, and we'll dive into transplant eligible, ineligible, and then particularly interested to hear Javier's experience with the on-body isatuximab device that he presented at ASCO. And if we have time, we'll get into some special situations, but there's a lot to talk about today. And in the middle of all this, as we often do, we did a survey of 20 investigators in myeloma, including our faculty. You'll be seeing the results of that survey, which is pretty interesting, as always, as we go through this. Last week, I met with Pete, and we recorded, or he recorded, a comprehensive presentation going through a lot of the key data that's relevant to our discussion today about first-line therapy. So we really envision this as a two-part program. First is his presentation, which is in the chat room. You can download it and watch it afterwards. And then to get into kind of a little bit more depth about what it means for clinical care as well as new research. Here's some of the papers. Here are the papers that Pete went through in the talk. It's really a great talk. I highly recommend it. We also have several cases that he presents during the talk. So check it out. We're not going to go through all these papers. We're going to kind of assume you're familiar with it, hopefully having seen this, at least in the future. And then we'll try to take it to the next level. So just to sort of get warmed up and, you know, Pete, I was mentioning that, you know, we know a lot of our audience is pretty new to oncology. About a quarter of our audience has been in oncology less than 5 years. And not everybody kind of realizes how rapidly things have changed, particularly in the last 5 years in myeloma. And I thought about that when you went through this case. And again, you went through it in detail. But the thing I thought was interesting, and you can elaborate a little bit about it without going through the whole case. This is an elderly man at TTR amyloidosis and a heart failure, but also had high risk of smoldering disease. And Pete, I thought your explanation of why you how you thought through and eventually decided to treat this patient with smoldering disease with daratumumab was interesting, because it kind of was the idea, and this is what I call a kind of a time capsule, of trying to move him out a few years to maybe when therapy would be more effective and maybe better tolerated. Can you comment a little bit more and also maybe try to put in perspective what you've seen in the first-line setting and, for that matter, in relapse disease and coming up in first-line over the last few years in myeloma, Pete?
Absolutely. You know, so this patient is older, has diastolic heart failure from TTR amyloidosis, reasonably well compensated, and a pretty significant neuropathic pain in their legs from severe lumbar spine stenosis. And the thing that we were considering that is, if we start a 3-drug or a 4-drug induction regimen for this patient, it may be hard as far as exacerbation of congestive heart failure, fluid retention, exacerbation of neuropathy. The patient meets criteria for high-risk disease as defined in the modern era by the 2220 criteria. He had had some evolving markers as far as the M spike is concerned. So, you know, this is a controversial area. So we took a shared decision-making approach, and we discussed the pros and cons of getting therapy or not. But we felt that daratumumab would be a well-tolerated therapy for this patient in spite of the comorbidities. And if we can delay progression to active disease, and this patient is clearly at high risk of progression to active disease, you know, that one, he may not need any additional treatment for his myeloma beyond single-agent daratumumab for 3 years. And if he does need treatment, to your point, the treatment paradigm may have completely changed by then. So we may have a bispecific antibody combination available. We may have CAR T-cell therapy available in the front line, you know, when he needs treatment again. You know, Xavier and I have been doing this, you know, when two drugs were the standard of care for newly diagnosed disease. We've gone to three drugs, and we're going to be talking a lot about four drug regimens for newly diagnosed patients these days. And the exceptional responses that we're seeing with T-cell redirecting therapies with CAR T and bispecific antibodies, just phenomenal. And the studies are ongoing in the newly diagnosed space, so we're going to see more changes in the future.
So we'll show a little data in the survey related to smoldering, Xavier. But any thoughts about this case? And you know, putting aside regulatory issues about whether or not you can actually access, for example, anti-CD38 antibody or daratumumab with smoldering myeloma, how would you, at least theoretically, think through a case like this or other cases of high-risk disease and balance out the question of whether to treat or not?
So in smoldering myeloma, we all agree that there are only three options. There are not that many more. Number one, you do not treat, you watch and wait. But most of the patients, they wish to be treated. Number two is Pete has proposed daratumumab single agent on the basis of the Aquila study, which is a very interesting option. And then the full bloom treatment of myeloma that we still don't know exactly what that looks like. It could be two or three drugs-based therapy, or really like the full treatment potentially with transplant for transplant-eligible patients. We still don't know exactly. But I do absolutely agree with Peter that there was two options for that patient, either to watch and wait and see. But likelihood of developing full-bloom myeloma, it's 2 to 5 years. It's 60 to 80% in 2 years. So it's quite a short time. Or immediately daratumumab and hope that it will delay it by 5 to 10 years. And I fully agree that then you discuss with the patient and it's patient take, in France, the patient takes a decision here.
Well, theoretically in the U.S., patients should be also making the decision as well, at least having that opportunity. Here are some of the results of the survey, and it looks like, Pete, either Dara is the most common choice. Actually, not too many people just don't treat or only treat on clinical trial, which I thought was pretty interesting. We asked what situations people would use it. You can see, obviously, if there's progression of disease, but patient preference is mentioned. When we get to the 80-year-old, we still see people treating now a lot more Dara. Any comments on what your colleagues are doing, Pete?
Yeah, so I agree with you. I was surprised that there were so few people that chose not to treat. You know, this is an area that still is debated hotly, even after the Aquila data were presented at ASH and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. You know, I will point out that in the NCCN guidelines now, single-agent daratumumab has a level 1, category for use in the high-risk smoldering myeloma space. So I think what you can see here is that there's an inclination to take the high-risk smoldering myeloma patient and treat them versus not treat them for the myeloma investigators. For the younger patient, multi-drug therapy, which is being explored in randomized studies as we speak, and for the older patient who may be more susceptible to, you know, toxicity of therapy, the single-agent daratumumab option is overwhelmingly preferred.
So, and here is the Aquila data, Xavier. I don't know if anything you want to say or point out about this trial. I was also thinking about how we were chatting before we got started here about your experience with the isatuximab one-body sub-Q delivery system and how a patient like this is on Dara alone. That seems like a great opportunity, maybe even to have the patient be treated at home. Anything you want to say about the Aquila data, Xavier, and again, the possibility of maybe a patient getting in the future sub-Q isatuximab or anti-CD38 antibodies at home?
So regarding Aquila's study, it's very important because it's a registrational study. So it's going to offer us daratumumab as an option and reimbursed, at least for us European and apparently in the US as well. So this is great. So the good thing is that it offers one more option, and CD38 monoclonal antibody are very well tolerated for the long run, particularly in frail and elderly and very elderly patients, or patients with comorbidities like the patients, Peter's patients with cardiac amyloid TTR. So clearly, it's an amazing option for our patients. If I try to find maybe one criticism to Aquila, the control arm is no treatment. It's watch and wait. So any treatment will always work better than watch and wait, which makes sense. There has been in the past lenalidomide and lenalidomide dexamethasone options. Aquila, to me, is really, really a paradigm shift changing. But if the control arm would have been len or lenalidomide dexamethasone, it would have potentially helped me for frail patients decide what could be the best single or two drug-based agent, daratumumab, compared to len, compared to lendex, something like that. In regards to the cetuximab OBI, as we have presented at ASCO and EHA this year, based on the Iraklia non-inferiority multicenter international registrational study, and based on a parallel study that was presented as a poster, ISALCO, the two studies demonstrated that the subcutaneous flat dose formulation of isatuximab with this on-body delivery system, we call an on-body injector, which seems to be so much better than the manual push, which seems to be better tolerated, safe, automated, really adapted to the thickness of the skin. Really is something incredible that we would have thought in the past about, that we would think isatuximab would be simply developed as a manual push. And it's incredible to see how the technology can develop and people imagine a new subcutaneous formulation way of giving the drugs.
So, Pete, we were talking about this when we recorded your presentation, and you brought up the fact also of nursing time, that, you know, if the patient's going to get treated in the clinic, then, you know, the nurse just puts it on and goes and does her thing. She doesn't have to stand there pushing it in. But also this possibility that, you know, and we'll talk about this more later. I'm really curious to hear more about it, that maybe patients are going to be able to treat themselves at home. I mean, right now you have insulin. You have half the population seems to be on GLP-1 drugs that they're giving themselves. Any thoughts about that scenario, Pete?
Yeah, I think that, you know, would be a wonderful option for patients, you know, whether it's a home health nurse coming in and administering subcutaneous daratumumab at the home or using the OBI, you know, subcutaneous isatuximab formulation at home. I think that's the holy grail. And I certainly think that this technology lends itself to home administration. You know, there's the challenges of the healthcare system in the United States and reimbursement issues that will need to be addressed in order to facilitate this, you know, option. But I think it would be a wonderful win for patients, you know, to be able to get the entirety of their treatment at home.
All right, well, let's start talking about first-line therapy of active disease, and we're going to start out talking about transplant-eligible. And Javier, you have this 63-year-old patient who, I love the case because you see this every day, and it's amazing that you see this every day, compared to, you know, even, let's say, 10 years ago. So can you kind of summarize what happened with this patient, what you see as sort of the teaching point? And also, I noticed in your write-up you talked about quote, education on myeloma was done. I'm curious what, you know, exactly what you teach patients who are first diagnosed with myeloma and how it played out in this man.
So there's so much we have to tell the patients about myeloma, about the future of myeloma, about the perspective for themselves, about work. That patient did still work at the time he was diagnosed, about the treatments, about the side effects, about there's so many things we have to discuss to the patient. Trust me, hours of education initially, because it's the only way for the patient to adhere nicely, smoothly to the treatment and cope with it and keep going. Remember, these patients are going to live probably 10 to 20 years, most likely 20 years. And so we're talking about treatment for 10, 20 years long. So you need to educate the patient and get the patient ready for that. So this case was a 63-year-old patient diagnosed based on bone pain, things that we know of, the regular things that happens with myeloma. A radiography confirmed, PET-CT confirmed that the patient had lytic lesion. The patient was non-high risk. And the labs really showed that the patient had measurable disease on IgG-kappa. So this patient on genomic had the translocation 11-14 positive type of myeloma, but again, nothing special here. Line one was the standard of care for us in Europe, based on a study called Perseus. That was a registrational study upfront, transplant-eligible patients, demonstrating that CD30 monoclonal antibody daratumumab had in the quadruped-based regimen DARA-VRD, really brought something great to the combination, to the VRD triplet-based combination. Bortezomib was giving twice weekly, lenalidomide at 25 milligrams. The patient had supportive care. Quite rapidly, the patient entered the GPR. Patient was collected for stem cell transplantations. And then the patient got transplanted with a regular conditioning regimen we use, I think, in the US, similar to Europe, to high-dose melphalan. Then the patient, after transplant, did great. The patient is in complete response. We don't run MRD on a routine practice. And then we have started the maintenance daratumumab lenalidomide. So what we wanted to discuss, what I thought it would be interesting to discuss with that case was, number one, discuss with Pete and you, Neil, the best treatment we can give today for patients up front that are transplantable. And at minimum, I think, based on Perseus regimen. Number two, the maintenance treatment is something that is given for years. The patient are going to be surviving without relapse, without death for 10, 15, maybe 20 years. Are we going to truly give a maintenance treatment for 10, 15, and 20 years? And what are the arguments, elements, and markers to decide when to stop, can we stop, for whom we can stop? And so for this patient, we gave daratumumab lenalidomide based on Perseus because it's available in France. And at 2 years, we started discussing with the patient whether the patient was happy to continue or not. And actually, the patient was very happy to stop. Patient seems to be non-high risk. The patient was in complete response, and the safety profile was acceptable. But the patient decided that he wanted to stop, and we decided to go with the decision of the patient, but not knowing whether that was a right or wrong decision. We'll know in 5 to 10 years.
So, Pete, you know, we could talk about this for a long time, but any brief comment? And also, Hassan in the chat room brings up the fact that with standard risk patients, quadruplet therapy, and he references the Perseus trial that we just talked about, is so effective. Do we still need a transplant, particularly in MRD negative patients? So I'll throw that one in as well, Pete.
Yeah, so I think that the data from the phase 3 Perseus study are unprecedented in the frontline, you know, paradigm. So DVRD followed by transplant, followed by Darolen maintenance for 2 years, followed by potential further maintenance, you know, beyond that, depending on the circumstances, is the right thing to do. When you compare the results from Perseus to the results from the phase 3 Cepheus trial, which looked at a fit transplant ineligible / deferred patient population, the progression-free survival is not as robust as what we see in the Perseus trial. So I think that there still is incremental advantage from a progression-free survival perspective with the upfront transplant, but there certainly is no doubt, you know, that patients, you know, with standard risk disease do well in the non-transplant scenario as well. I don't think we're quite yet there to use MRD to make decisions about whether you do the transplant or you don't do the transplant. There is a wonderful IFM study, a phase 3 study called the MIDAS trial that Xavier participated in, you know, which looks at MRD adapted based therapy in the frontline space. And for those patients that are MRD negative after 6 cycles of ESA KRD induction therapy, they're randomly assigned to either get transplanted and then they go on the maintenance therapy, or they get additional cycles of ESA KRD followed by maintenance therapy. And the MRD negative rates at 10 to the minus 6 going into maintenance therapy are exactly the same for those that got the transplant versus those that did not. So that's a really interesting result, a very good first place to start. I want to see sustained MRD negativity before I make a change into my practice. And the projected median progression-free survival for the quadruplet and transplant in the Perseus study is 17 years. We're not talking about overall survival. We're talking about progression-free survival. Now, you know, there's caveats to a projected progression-free survival, but I think a lot of us do anticipate that that median progression-free survival is going to be beyond 10 years. And to the point we were talking about previously, you know, the standard of care for myeloma will be completely different, you know, at that point.
So while you were talking, two comments popped up in the chat room. They're almost identical, one from Steve, the other from Salman, who says, do you have any preference for Dyer versus ESA? I'm just going to hold off on that because we're going to take a look at some of the data, and maybe that's going to change a little bit, too, in terms of this on-body device that we referred to. Again, this is a case that Pete discussed in more detail, another patient who is transplant eligible, another patient who is doing really well. But the thing I thought was interesting about this case, I wanted to get Xavier's thoughts about it, is that you switched this patient from bortezomib to carfilzomib during the second cycle because of neuropathy, which was, I thought was interesting that it popped up so quickly that you made that decision. And I was just kind of curious if, Xavier, have you ever faced that situation where you switched and, you know, as part early on in induction?
Absolutely. And I totally agree with Peter on this decision here. So most of the patients that receive bortezomib, even weekly, if it's long enough, will develop some neurotoxicity at some point. This neurotoxicity is very annoying to patients. It gets back to grade one if you stop the treatment, but in many patients does not entirely resolve. It's kind of really depressing to know that patient will live 17 years potentially with only one line, as Peter has summarized on Perseus, having a sequelae really handicapping the patients with neurotoxicity grade 1. So I fully agree. If we should not be using potentially bortezomib up front. We should be using carfilzomib if we could. It's not available for many of us worldwide, so we start with bortezomib. But as soon as the patient develops a neurotoxicity event, I fully recommend that we switch to carfilzomib. Absolutely agree. Then I'm interested in knowing what dose you use, Pete, on the carfilzomib here, 56 or 70 milligram per meter squared.
56 milligram per meter squared.
I think it's safe. It's. I agree to that, absolutely.
And I know the patient's doing well. So here are some results from our survey. Pretty interesting. Not too surprising that quad therapy is standard of care. Right now, DAR-RVD, again, I know a lot of that's being driven. We'll see some poll results later by the sub-Q availability of DARA. But I was really curious about how people approach maintenance and whether or not they look at MRD. So we asked people what they did. And actually, there is a fair amount of difference, a lot more use of DARA-R in patients who are MRD positive. Pete, any thoughts about upfront quad versus not using an anti-CD38? Do you want to dip your toe into the waters of, let's just talk about efficacy of Dyer versus ESA from what we've seen, and particularly these interesting trends in terms of making decisions about maintenance?
Yeah, I think that the randomized data are clear. Quadruplet therapy for newly diagnosed patients, particularly the fitter myeloma patients, is the right thing to do. I think you've got very strong data supporting the use of isatuximab in this situation. You have very good data supporting daratumumab, and I would not say that one's necessarily better than the other. You've got very good data supporting the use of bortezomib as the proteasome inhibitor. You have very excellent phase 3 data supporting carfilzomib as the proteasome inhibitor of choice. For me, whether I use bortezomib or carfilzomib boils down to neuropathy. I usually will use DARA-VRD as my upfront strategy. What's really interesting is the maintenance results. So when you look at the prescribing information for DARA-VRD in the United States, the DARA-LEN maintenance for 2 years component was not included in the label. And the criticism that the FDA leveled on the study, and they, you know, the reviewers of our Griffin study leveled on us, is that there was not a second randomization to either single agent LEN or DARA-LEN in the maintenance setting. So how much of the PFS benefit is from the daratumumab that was given as part of induction and post-transplant consolidation versus the maintenance therapy? And there's really truly no way to know unless you do that second randomization. So we've got, you know, the GMMG HD7, you know, phase 3 trial that's ongoing in Germany as we speak. And there was a second randomization to len versus isatuximab lenalidomide after recovery from stem cell transplant. And that's really going to definitively answer the question, you know, whether you can use one or two drugs. But there's really no data, you know, whether using one versus two drugs in an MRD positive versus negative situation is the best approach. From my perspective, you know, if the patient's tolerating therapy, you should mimic the randomized data that led to those excellent results in the first place. So stick to the script, do Dara-Len for 2 years if insurance will allow, you know, and if they're tolerating Len, continue it beyond that point.
So, Xavier, before we get into your thoughts about this, I also want to show you some other results in terms of length of therapy. Most commonly is indefinite in the standard risk situation. We asked what the approach is to transplant, and again, standard risk situation. And people are kind of split between just, you know, recommending it or, you know, bringing the patient in. I assume the patient's going to be part of it no matter what, but it seems like not everybody's as enthusiastic. I was wondering whether people approach African-American patients differently, and not apparently, even though there's some interesting data. And then here's what we saw when we asked the same questions related to high risk, in this case, DEL17P, Xavier, a lot more carfilzomib being used, and a lot more DARA-R being used in maintenance, although we were joking. We've been doing these surveys for a long time, and we had to come up with a new color scheme. We had so many different answers for this survey. We had to do a new key for it. But again, there's a lot we could say about these survey data. You know, we call what we do going beyond the guidelines. The guidelines give you evidence-based information. What we ask to do is we show you, like, what do people actually do, knowing that a lot of times there's not a perfect answer. Any thoughts, Xavier?
No, as Peter has very nicely said, when you compare Perseus and Cepheus, clearly, I do believe today transplant is better than no transplant if a patient can be transplanted and is willing to be transplanted. So I would stick to that. As Pete has said, nice expression, stick to the script. So I like it very much. Number one. Number two, the best induction regimen quadruple-based is ISA-KRD on the basis of MIDAS study, the study we recently published in Nuclear Medicine, or Perot, first author. And in that study, the MRD negativity rate 10 to minus 5 after 6 cycles induction was 64%, which is unprecedented, 10 to 20% better than any other regimen, including Dara-VRd, Isa-VRd, etc. So if you can give carfilzomib instead of bortezomib, you're going to give a much better dose-dense, dose-intense treatment, which is very key for high-risk myeloma patients. For high-risk myeloma patients, you need to stick to the script and give the best treatment you can give and stick to it as long as possible. For this patient, it's absolutely key if you want to save months of survival. And so that's why it's no surprise to me here that in standard risk myeloma, carfilzomib was not necessarily a number one option, but for high risk myeloma, it becomes a number one option because it's much safer, carfilzomib, than bortezomib.
So, and also here we see most people going with, you know, again, high risk situation, but indefinite therapy approach, a lot more interest in early transplant in the high risk patient. And also this practical question, Pete, should, you know, we hear investigators all the time talking about MRD, and then the docs in the community want to know, or should we be doing it? Which assay should we be doing? So we asked people, should community-based docs be using MRD? And actually, quite a few, almost half, said no. What are your thoughts, Pete? And what assay, if you're going to do it, which assay?
So as far as the assay, that's the easier part to answer. You know, I think both next-generation sequencing and flow cytometry are excellent approaches. If you can get MRD with sensitivity to 10 to the minus 6, you're in a good spot. So I think either one of those approaches is fair. There, you know, we talked about the MIDAS study just now, and I had alluded to it earlier, you know, that used MRD adapted approach for those that are MRD negative versus MRD positive, you know, after that initial quad induction followed by, you know, transplant. And, you know, we may be able to, after induction, we may be able to, take our foot off the accelerator and defer the transplant, based on the data from that study. But I do want to see sustained MRD negativity results from MIDAS before I start doing that. We don't have any randomized data that stopping treatment based off of MRD negativity is the right thing to do. There was a wonderful study that was published in Blood recently by the Greek myeloma team where they took patients who are on maintenance therapy for 3+ years. They're in a complete metabolic response by PET CT. They're MRD negative at 10^-6 and they stop. And with early looks at those patients, they're doing very well. Again, it's not randomized. Would they do better if they just continued? It remains to be seen. The dramatic study, the SWOG 1803 study, is randomizing patients to continuing their maintenance versus stopping it if they're MRD negative at 10^-6, 2 years into their maintenance therapy. And I think that'll really help address that question. In clinical practice, I will use MRD testing in a high-risk patient after transplant to see if they're MRD positive or not, to see if they need post-transplant consolidation before I go on to maintenance therapy. So that might be a clinical scenario where you would want to use it. If you have a patient that's tolerating maintenance therapy poorly, they've been on it for 2+ years, they've got bad fatigue from their lenalidomide, diarrhea, et cetera, I'll do MRD testing and PET CT imaging at that point to see what their disease status is. And particularly if they're a standard risk patient, we will oftentimes stop in those circumstances.
So we're going to move on in a second and talk about transplant ineligible patients. I just want to kind of flash through the slides that Pete covered in his talk and encourage you to take a look at it. Here's the Perseus study, some more recent data. The GMMG HD7 trial, Isakia trial. Also, we talked about maintenance treatment with CD38. Here are some of the trials that Pete, the Auriga trial, that Pete discusses in his talk and some of the data there. And also the Cassiopeia study, again, looking at this important question. And analyses that have been done looking at MRD assays. And again, refer you to Pete's talk for a review of this really interesting data. But let's get into the transplant ineligible patient. And Xavier, can you talk a little bit about your 75-year-old man?
Thank you, Neil. So a patient that was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in the monitoring when the patient was admitted for a severe bronchopneumonia, that was pneumococcal infection, which is not that frequent even these days, but we still see a lot of patients diagnosed this way because of the hypogammaglobulinemia, profound immunosuppression induced by myeloma. And so the patient on biology was diagnosed with myeloma, clearly. Serum free light chain, kappa 3000 ratio, 1500. So clearly myeloma that was slim crab, needed treatment, multiple lytic lesion on PET CT, no plasmacytoma. So at 75 years old, in the past, we were using triplet-based regimen based on MAIA, daratumumab, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, with the three big three studies, Cepheus, IMROS, and Benefit. We now have, I think, more than thousands of patients treated a quadruplet-based regimen in the transplant deferred and transplant ineligible 65, 70 to 80 years old window. And so my patient being 75 years old, we offer that patient a quadruplet-based regimen. Then the discussion, so isatuximab, bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. Then the question was, do you use bortezomib twice weekly or weekly? In IMROS and Cepheus, it was used twice weekly. In Benefit, it was used weekly. The three studies provided similar data, so we went twice weekly, and then the patient experienced neurotoxicity. I remember that we moved to weekly, and the patient kept improving. Again, back to the same discussion we had with the maintenance, but here post-transplant, but here without transplant, which is, technically speaking, Cepheus, IMROS, and Benefit, the quadruplet-based arm, will project a median PFS around 80-100 months, so about 10 years. And so for how long you continue the treatment? Again, if Pete proposed to stick to the protocol, to stick to the script, meaning treated until progression, 8 to 10 years, and after 4 years from diagnosis, the patient was sick of it and wanted to stop the treatment, which I think most of us, we experience in the real life. And then it's a question how convinced you are, how you can convince the patient to continue.
Pete, any comments? Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, this is a patient with high-risk disease, right? They've got the full 14 translocation. They've got GAIN1Q. So a four-drug strategy here is the absolute right thing to do. And to Xavier's point, we've got three randomized phase three studies supporting that approach. So I think that's the exact right thing to do. And in this case, I would continue the CD38 antibody and lenalidomide until disease progression, provided they're tolerating the therapy well.
So, Pete, maybe you can comment also on this 73-year-old, quote, transplant-ineligible patient, but maybe not. Also, I want you to comment on the fact that he had Parkinson's disease and how that affected the way you thought about this case. Can you comment on the case?
Yeah, so this poor patient had extensive compression fractures throughout their spine at initial presentation. So clinically, the patient was in bad shape and had an ECOG performance status of 3. That said, there was no high-risk disease biology here, but given the degree of debility that he had and uncertainty about how his Parkinson is going to play out over the course of time, we elected not to even talk about an upfront transplant, you know, when we initially started treatment. I said, it's out there. We can revisit it if things change, but we kind of put that in the parking lot, you know, at initial discussion. And it's really been, you know, just gratifying to see this patient kind of come back to life, if you will, with a wonderful response to therapy. So they're in a very good partial response after 4 cycles of therapy, moving very quickly on their way to a complete response. We've had to do a couple of kyphoplasties because of the degree to which the back was compromised by the compression fractures. And the patient is thriving, and they're doing very well, and they're living independently. They've had Parkinson's disease for many years now, actually. It was a very early onset, and it's been fairly stable. So we had a discussion about collecting stem cells in this case, and we elected to do so, but defer transplant. And I think the only circumstance where I would consider it in this case, given the circumstances, is if we had an unexpectedly short duration of remission. So if he comes out of remission far sooner than anticipated, that would be a scenario where I would talk with him about the possibility of doing a transplant as part of second-line therapy. Given the Parkinson's disease, I would not give him cilta-cel, you know, CAR T-cell therapy in first relapse because of the comorbidity of Parkinson's disease.
So again, Xavier, any comments on this case? And also, I don't know, like sometimes I wonder if I'm the last person to think about it, but the idea of how Parkinson's relates to the question about using bortezomib was something I hadn't thought about. And I am curious what your thoughts are. Do you generally try not to use it? Do you use carfilzomib instead? What types of Parkinsonian syndromes get you to shy away more from bortezomib? And any other comments about this case?
No, you're absolutely right, Neil. And we discussed with Peter the option of not using bortezomib for this patient already suffering from neurotoxicity, from neurologic disease, and not adding neurotoxicity of bortezomib, even though it's not the same symptoms, but it will alter the ability of the patient to cope with Parkinson syndrome, particularly the walking issues of Parkinson syndromes and the one induced by the neurological toxicity of bortezomib. So we discussed whether it was possible in the US. It's not in Europe. Exceptional cases. This could be an exceptional case where you could use carfilzomib instead of bortezomib. But then you have to still be careful with one thing, which is Parkinson syndrome sometimes have cardiac issues. And so you have to be careful with the carfilzomib. So again, it's a trade-off, bortezomib neurotoxicity versus carfilzomib potential, the rare events of cardiac issues. If you could, I would propose carfilzomib instead of bortezomib here. But again, if you monitor the bortezomib, as Peter has said, he has started at 1.0 milligram per square meter, which is very safe. We know that on a weekly basis. Again, very safe, very rare events of neurotoxicity. So We're trying indeed.
No, that's a really great point. I hadn't thought about in terms of the functional impact of having a peripheral neuropathy when you already have functional impact of the Parkinson's. So that's a really interesting and valid point. And again, Pete, going back to our survey here, we see a consensus, just kidding, about how to handle transplant-ineligible patients. A significant number of people saying DARA-RD, others saying the quad. I was kind of surprised more people. Well, now this is actually 80 years old, so maybe that's the difference. I don't know whether they would have said the same thing, but still, that's kind of young, I would say. Pete, how do you decide between DARA-RD and DARA-RVD?
So going back to the three phase three studies we were talking about previously, so Cepheus, IMROS, and BENEFIT, you know, all of those studies allowed patients to enroll, you know, through age 80. So this patient is right at the upper cutoff. Now in Cepheus and BENEFIT, you know, it was fitter patients, you know, that were enrolled into those trials. So frail was specifically excluded. In IMROS, there was about 25-30% or so of the patients in that study who were considered frail, but there was clear PFS benefit in all three studies. So I think if this patient is, you know, fairly fit, I think a quadruplet is definitely on the table. I was a little surprised based on these three phase three trials that there weren't more people choosing the quadruplet. But to your point, I think 80 is right at the upper edge of the cutoff of those three phase three studies. And this is a standard risk patient, which may have swayed the vote a little bit as well.
Right. And again, here's in terms of maintenance therapy, most people, even a standard risk, are saying a DARA-R indefinitely. We also asked about Javier, the high-risk patient. Now we see a lot more quad being used with DARA-RVD. Maintenance therapy, again, a lot of variations here, but a fair amount in, with the DEL-17P of DARA-R, again, indefinitely. Any comment about the high-risk transplant-ineligible patients, Javier?
So you're right, Neil. It's no surprise to me that more of our colleagues have proposed a quadruplet for that 80 years old, again, at the edge of the age experience we have with the quadruplet-based regimens. In high-risk myeloma, you try to give the best treatment to the patient, and you're willing to take some risk for the patient, and you explain to the patient. We talked about education. You educate the patient to the fact that there might be some risk to take if we really want the patient to benefit from the treatment. In standard risk or non-high risk, it's more difficult because you never know quadruplet versus triplet above 80 years old, although I personally give a quadruplet as much as I can. And I like to remind all my colleagues that if you don't like quadruplet and you like triplet, pick the quadruplet, get rid of dexamethasone, and here you have a triplet.
So haven't you heard that 80 is a new 65? Anyhow, again, here's some of the data that Peter goes through in his talk in terms of the variety. Here's the IMROS study variety. And also this conclusion, one thing I want to just pick out and bring this back up that you mentioned as part of your talk that I thought was interesting is patients who do not receive, and I don't know how, I imagine it's not rare, even though it seems to be standard of care, there's always some sort of people who get delayed. But the management of maintenance therapy in patients who don't receive upfront anti-CD38 therapy and whether or not MRD status is a consideration. You say DARA and LEN maintenance is a new standard of care for patients who are MRD positive after not getting induction with CD38. So again, putting aside regulatory issues, Xavier, how do you manage a patient you're seeing in second opinion who has gotten a non-CD38 induction regimen? Do you routinely include it or just in the MRD-positive patients post-transplant?
Oh, I think we've seen in across this discussion today and all the studies, more than five studies with transplant eligible patients, three studies with transplant ineligible patients, all registrational, almost all phase three studies, thousands of patients treated. The addition of CD38 combination antibody, daratumumab or isatuximab, I won't discuss daratumumab or isatuximab here, is absolutely key. It's a loss of chance for the patients not to add CD38 monoclonal antibody up front in a quadruplet-based regimen as much as possible. And if you look at the safety profile of the quadruplet-based regimen, the drug that has the least safety profile issues is actually the CD38 monoclonal antibody. Bortezomib, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone carry most of the side effect issues, and most of the time, the CD38 monoclonal antibody really carries very limited safety issues. So there is no reason not to offer a CD38 monoclonal antibody to patients up front. It makes so much of a difference.
Pete, any comments?
Yeah, I was just going to say that comment in my conclusion was really driven at the ARIGA study, which looked at len versus daralen for patients who had gotten induction therapy without a CD38 antibody followed by a transplant. And to meet eligibility for the study, you had to be MRD positive. And there was a very clear benefit with the two-drug therapy versus the one. You know, and again, going back to Perseus, you know, there wasn't a second randomization. You know, everybody who started on the quadruplet got Dara as part of their maintenance therapy as well. So the question comes up, how much of the benefit of the CD38 is from the initial versus the maintenance or a combination of both? And again, that's where that GMMG HD7 study is going to be so vital.
What about the patient who's MRD negative, Pete? You still would you hold off on Dara maintenance, or would you use it if they hadn't had it in induction?
So, you know, again, going back to the Perseus study and sticking to the script, that's the theme of tonight's discussion. I would try and, you know, use Daralen maintenance for 2 years, and if they remain MRD negative, I would stop the Dara at that point. But, you know, I will fully submit, you know, that the GMMG HD7 study could show that, you know, maybe the CD38 is not important if you've gotten it as part of induction therapy, in which case, you know, my practice may change.
Incidentally, the script is really impressive, incidentally, and a good reason to stick with it. Xavier, you had a thought?
Yeah, I wish to disagree with Peter on this one. Usually, I always agree with Peter, but on this one, I will disagree because I know how Perseus was built on, and I know why daratumumab was stopped after 2 years sustained MRD negativity and lenalidomide continue, although I would have personally do the other way around. I would have stopped len and continued daratumumab for the sake of the safety profile for the patients and maintaining the patients on long-term maintenance, at least with one agent in MRD negative patients. So I wish we would have stopped len and continued daratumumab. And in my real life, I wish if I had to continue one of the two drugs to stop len and continue daratumumab in MRD negative patients.
Very good point.
Yeah, there are a lot of people in practice feel the same way. So I'm really looking forward to this next session. I keep asking people, have you ever had a patient want to get the one body device? And there's so few people out there. I'm so thrilled to be able to talk to Javier. And I guess this is a great example, a 53-year-old man. What happened with him?
So that patient, thank you, Neil, that patient was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. So probably we can move to the next slide rapidly. That patient was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in the context of renal insufficiency, CAS nephropathy. That patient was not obviously high risk, although 60% plasma cells and gained 1Q, but no high risk. The patient was immediately, being 53 years old, started with the standard of care, Dara, bortezomib, dexamethasone, hydration, correction of hypercalcemia, to try to control the renal insufficiency, and then on a quadruplet-based regimen. Bortezomib was given twice weekly, and lenalidomide at 10 milligrams per day, 21 days, 1 week off, because the patient recovered in part from renal insufficiency with a clearance above 30, but no better than 40 ml minute. And probably the audience now that you need to adapt the lenalidomide to the renal clearance. The thing is that the patient started on bortezomib twice weekly. The patient was really annoyed by diarrhea, annoyed by neurotoxicity. And then the patient was only at cycle 3, 53 years old. Induction was halfway through. We had not collected stem cell yet. And really, we were in trouble with treating this patient. And we knew that if we failed induction, the patient would really have a dismal survival, dismal perspectives here. So we discussed the switch from Dara-VRD to Isa-KRD. So we switched bortezomib to carfilzomib, sort of similar to the case that Peter presented earlier on. Because ISAC-ERD is a regimen that is ongoing, studied in ISCHIA, we were able to use ISAC-ERD, but we had to switch daratumumab to acetuximab if we switched bortezomib to carfilzomib. This is how it was in Europe. And so we were able to give actually acetuximab subcutaneous flat dose, 1400 milligram with the OBI. And immediately with carfilzomib and the acetuximab. So with the acetuximab, the safety profile immediately improved. With the carfilzomib, the efficacy immediately improved. The patient entered great response. The patient could go through the entire treatment. The patient is doing great now. And the patient is willing, happy to continue the treatment, not stopping the maintenance treatment. Because the patient really liked the OBI very, very much with this completely new paradigm shift way of giving a subcutaneous formulation to patients, again, with this device called OBI.
So you were saying that he was wanting to give it to himself at work?
And exactly, the patient is CEO of a pharma company, and I should not say pharma, a company. And he loves the OBI, and because it's really he goes to the pharmacy, gets a set, doesn't even call the nurse, do it on his own at home. He knows how to plug things and get the OBI. Again, the OBI is really automated, really take into consideration the thickness of your skin, really infuse very regularly the drug, so there's no much local reaction, less 1.5% local reaction grade 1 only, compared to 7% with a subcutaneous manual push. And so really the patient is happy with the treatment, and it's important because then the patient can adhere to the idea that the treatment will last for years, years and years. Probably more than 10 years in his case, hopefully.
So, and, you know, I love it when you see patient-reported outcomes. A lot of times, you know, quality of life, patient-reported outcomes, I look at it, I can't quite figure out what's going on. But I know you reported some data actually comparing sub-Q Dara to this on-body device where you were able to show differences in measurements. Any thoughts about it, and also sort of your subjective experience Xavier?
Absolutely, Neil. So in the ISALCO study that was presented as a poster to at ASCO and EHA, the patient were randomized. It was actually a very smart way of designing the study. The patient were randomized. It's called by FDA naming preference, patient preference, you know. And so the question was, patient randomized to receive 3 months OBI, then 3 months manual push, or 3 months manual push, then 3 months OBI. And 75% versus 17% of the patients, 75 versus 70% of the patients preferred the OBI. So you really can say that the OBI sub-Q formulation is much better, at least for 75% of the patients, compared to the sub-cut manual push.
So we'll see how this plays out. We were talking about the heterogeneity of responses in the survey. Here's an example where there is no heterogeneity. We asked people, do you think there's any difference? Of course, obviously, is it indirect comparison? Always a challenge in oncology. But it seems to be at least a consensus about the fact that it's pretty hard, if impossible, to differentiate these compounds based on the efficacy data, whether or not these other considerations will come in. Who knows? There are some people already starting to think that they might prefer the ESA formulation. We'll see what happens. Here it is. Do you get a different one every? How often do you sort of get a different device, Javier? How often do you switch it? Or do you just use the same thing and keep put the syringe in?
No, so the syringe is already inside the device. Actually, one of the beauty of the device is that you don't see the syringe. You don't see the syringe. When you stick the device to your skin, you pull the ribbon and you push on the button, then the syringe gets out the device into your skin. So you can only use it once, because it would not be sterile if it goes out and in your skin. Into the system. So you have to use it once. If there's maybe one limitation to that pretty genius device, is that it's only used for one time. So you have to destroy it, you have to trash it and use another one. So ecologically speaking, it could be better. But they are thinking if they could reuse it, but it's difficult because of the sterility of the needle.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of, again, GLP devices that are getting thrown in the trash every day. Of course, that is a one-time also usage. So let's finish out with a couple of things that we've already alluded to briefly. You can take a look at all the results of this are in the chat room. But, Pete, anything you want to say about your approach to patients with renal failure not requiring dialysis? We said it's an 80-year-old patient not eligible for transplant. Fair amount of heterogeneity, but any thoughts? So how do you approach it, Pete?
So if they're sick enough that they're hospitalized, we will typically start with a CyBorD-based approach. But as they get better and we start to better understand what their kind of new baseline renal function is going to be when we transition them to the outpatient arena, we take out the cyclophosphamide and we replace it with appropriately dosed lenalidomide. If they're just on the outpatient side of things, we prefer to use renally dosed lenalidomide instead of cyclophosphamide in those circumstances. I mean, you've got good data, again, from the IFM group, you know, showing that a proteasome inhibitor, you know, IMID-DEX-based approach is better than cyclophosphamide proteasome inhibitor DEX-based approach for newly diagnosed patients. You've got nice data from the randomized phase 2 Forte study that shows that KRD is better than KCD, you know, so I want to give these patients, you know, the benefit of the best treatment. You have to be careful with lenalidomide and how you're dosing it in these patients, and they do tend to have more side effects in spite of the dose modification, so you have to use it cautiously. But I still use the same approach that I do with my other patients. I just dose things differently.
So, Xavier, any comments?
I fully agree with Peter. We these days, we stay away from cyclophosphamide because you lose if the patient develop infection. We usually stick to daratumumab, bortezomib, dexamethasone as standard of care. But I fully agree with Pete. We, as early as possible, we use lenalidomide, but you have to be very cautious in the dose of lenalidomide because you have to dose adapt on the and calculate as best as possible the dose of lenalidomide according to clearance creatinine. And if the clearance creatinine keep moving up and down, it's risky to start the lenalidomide. It's better when it's more stable. Agree with Peter on this one.
Yeah.
So, Pete and Xavier, thank you so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Pete. Thanks so much, Xavier. Have a great one.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.